Let's talk. John Brown. Borderlines is a history of Europe told from the edges, talking about Europe's internal borders, which have rarely been natural. They've often been created by accident or force. And in Borderlines, political historian Louis Baston journeys around 29 key borders from West to East Europe, talking about how the map has been changed. I'm delighted to say that he joins me live on the line, probably from somewhere at a checkpoint or sort of crossing a border somewhere. Louis, good morning to you.
Very good morning, Giles.
Where do we find you? Are you scuttling? Are you deciding whether you're in the Low Countries, Belgium, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, or you're just going to go to Schleswig-Holstein and call the whole thing off?
I'm in a complex border zone between the London boroughs of Camden and Westminster at the moment. Mentally, I'm with you in Spain.
well, exactly. So we just sort of briefly talked about Spain off air. I mean, Spain's got the Pyrenees, and the joke used to be, didn't it? Africa started at the Pyrenees. And so we're kind of not talking about those borders, but there is sort of a really interesting and complex way that for centuries, you know, the Low Countries, the Benelux, the Spanish Netherlands, call them what you will, and that was before the Iron Curtain came down, had been drawn and redrawn, and nobody's quite sure where Strasbourg is, and as for Alsace, you know, who can even work out which football team I'm supporting this week? So what's the spark then, Louis, that behind this book?
I'd always been intrigued by places on the edge. The tracing it back to the very early spark, it was a bus journey, a coach journey I did in 1984, cross the border between Strasbourg and Germany. And there's this moment where stuff just changes. You're on the other side, the language is different. And being an English guy, being from sort of Southampton originally, this was new to me. Abroad was somewhere kind of you had to make a specific effort to go to, whereas I realized there are places where you just walk across a bridge or past a sign and you're in a foreign country. And that idea was, I guess I have a sort of childish imagination about this kind of stuff, which is the start of a lot of books that you just go, wow. And it's like sort of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. There's another country at the back of your wardrobe. And Alice Through the Looking Glass. So if you've got that kind of imagination, I think the idea of a physical border really is something intriguing. And it's something I kind of followed up. And my sort of professional life, I've always been interested at looking at the edge cases. A reference that was once written for me said I had an interest in the curious, the marginal, and the bizarre. And that stayed with me. And I made something of it in this book. And it was great fun. It was educational. It was intriguing. I should also say it was a bit of a kind of indirect response to the way the debate went in Britain about Brexit, that there was a lot of talk about borders then. And we as British don't know very much about borders, or sort of inland British as opposed to British who live on the mainland of Europe. Mm. And we rather forgot during the Brexit debate that Britain, the UK, does have a land border in Ireland. And so my first instinct was to go and have a look at that border. And then I realised, actually, it's part of a much larger story.
Because we tend to think that with borders, I mean, we grew up, Sunday afternoon watching World War II movies, so we expect borders to have checkpoints and towers and Steve McQueen leaping over barbed wire fences. But, you know, once you get in, I mean, I famously drove out of Brussels airport one time in a rented Twingo, took the wrong direction, said to my partner, can you just see where we're going? Because there seemed to be an awful lot of trucks. What does that sign say? And it said Rotterdam. We'd driven into the next country by mistake. You can do that.
Yes, that's right. It's something quite new in a lot of Europe. I mean, Benelux is a bit special. They've had kind of free movement for longer than any of the rest of us. But it was really at the same kind of time I was thinking about, isn't this border between Strasbourg and Germany a kind of weird transformation? Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand were talking about, hey, wouldn't it be a good idea to sort of drop the border theatre that goes on, all the checkpoints and passport stamping and so on that you get, and have free movement. And from that came the process that became the Schengen Treaty. And so you've got really a remarkable couple of things happening in Europe. You've got the customs union and the Schengen Treaty, and borders are kind of softer than they have been for a while. I mean, let's not forget, though, that before the 19th century, national borders, as we know them now, didn't really exist. There was a lot softer, a lot more kind of capability for free movement across them. So in a sense, what you had in the 19th and 20th centuries was this sort of toughening up of borders. And in mainland Europe, anyway, it's become softer.
But you can argue with that, and look out, I warned you, you can argue with that because it is, places become nation states. So places like Germany becomes a nation. I mean, people tend to forget Germany is an incredibly young nation. They ditch all they still have the von what's-its and the van that whatevers, but it becomes a single nation. Italy. Yeah. Most famously, which has been a succession of, I mean, all the way back to sort of, you know, Venice, Florence, Medici, Milan, the Lombard, you know, that becomes a single nation. So whereas before you just need, and as for, and I've just finished reading about the Plantagenets. So as for Henry II going all the way down to Aquitaine and running, you know, and there's no such thing as France in at that period of time. So what you need is basically, if you like, a bill of travel or safe passage. You don't need because otherwise you would spend your entire time, you know, crossing borders and barriers and whatever. But it's when we have nations, proper nations, and that idea of national identity in a huge way that France, that Germany then have, that you need to have borders in.
In the age of empires before the First World War, it was actually quite easy to cross borders. You didn't need a passport even for some of them. What was difficult was transporting goods. You'd have to sort of do a kind of customs check at the border station if you were traveling and so on. What we have with, I mean, the nation state brought about a lot of border control, and a lot of people in the kind of heartland of the nation state feel quite good about that. But every story is local somewhere. And when you whack a border down and start checking people going across it, it does cut through the kind of web of cross-border connections that exist at some of these places. I mean, it varies. Even in the under the Iron Curtain, there were people who sort of would commute back and forth between Poland and Czechoslovakia, for instance. There is this sort of, there are two kind of warring things in this sort of human soul, I think. The desire to draw borders and to define your tribe, and also the fact that people on the border, their lives don't necessarily respect the border. It's a bit muddy. I mean, take for instance, I was in a town called Ostritz in eastern Germany and was asking somebody for a restaurant recommendation. And they talked me about this place, gave me some directions. And the restaurant was in Poland. And they hadn't mentioned that. And I'd assumed the restaurant would be in the same country. But the border mentality is a bit different. The people go back and forth across the border. People also kind of try and get the best of both worlds quite often when they're in a border territory.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, with a lot of these things, I mean, Alsace-Lorraine has changed. I mean, they have changed. They've been French. They've been German. I mean, obviously, anywhere between Germany and Poland has been, I mean, your grandfather could have been Polish, you could have been German, you could be Polish, you could be a citizen of the Soviets, for goodness sake. I mean, that idea of a nationality sort of changes a lot. And I suppose it is that sort of independent streak. I mean, if I was to get in the car and it worked and I drove 30 minutes to the west from here, I'd hit Gibraltar, which has kind of got a border, but the majority of people who work in Gibraltar work in the Spanish town La Linea, the line, which is next to it. So the people who, they cross every day. So while politicians may say it is Spanish and it will, this is Spain and Gibraltar, the people who actually live there have got much more sort of fluid look to it.
Absolutely. I love the fact that the town is called La Linea.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just the most borderline phenomenon you can have. And it happens to some extent. I mean, what one of the things that, because the rise of the nation state was accompanied by the state doing more for us in terms of health and pensions and working regulation and so on. And cross-border working is quite a complex thing sometimes in terms of the bureaucracy of it. And this is something that actually nation states don't really care about. It affects a fairly small proportion of people within the nation state. Where you get people caring about it are at the regional and local level. Often regional governments and local governments have good relations across the border. And you also get it at the EU level. I mean, the EU does all sorts of painstaking and sort of bureaucratic things to try and make it easier for people to go back and forward for work. And I mean, there is a Spanish kind of end to this, that the border between sort of Spain and northern Portugal, for instance, is there are quite a few people who work one side and live the other. And this is something, yeah, that that the European level cares about and the regional governments care about, but the nation states, not really.
Mm. When you talk, we talk about, because this all changed, obviously, a lot of this was set up when, you know, as I said before, an iron curtain is falling across Europe, as Winston famously said, but that iron curtain has kind of gone, and it opened up, obviously, in after sort of the revolutions, peaceful or otherwise, of 1989-1991, you suddenly have these nations who have, you know, former Warsaw Pact or, you know, Eastern European nations, who then obviously start to disintegrate in the terms that obviously most horrendously in the terms of what happens in former Yugoslavia, but also Czechoslovakia. I was saying that the other day, and I thought, how strange to say Czechoslovakia. You know, rather than Slovakia and the Czech Republic, and all these, you know, Bratislava, all these nations start to sort of be, you know, redraw themselves. I mean, did you look at any of those nations, and what's the experience been like for them? Because
very much. I mean, the Czech and Slovak republics, their borderline is a very old border. I mean, it was the border basically between the Austrian and the Hungarian half of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So people knew where the line was between Czech Republic and Slovakia. Yugoslavia is different. I mean, again, you had the sort of ethnic questions in Yugoslavia. You had the sort of central state and the Serbian interests being very intermeshed with each other. So you had this the war, but also in Yugoslavia, the other sort of thing, less serious than, of course, than the wars of the 90s, was that a lot of the borders were not very well specified. Mm. There's all sorts of complexities, like you have to sort of, which house pays, if you're in a house near the border, which side have you been paying taxes to? What side does this document from some medieval transaction between lords say you're on? And so there are some places between Serbia and Croatia where neither side claims the territory. And so you get entrepreneurs coming in and sort of saying, oh, let's find a little country in this this loophole. And you've got a couple of little bits of Croatia that are surrounded by Slovenia. So breaking up a country involves all sorts of complexity. And the breakup of the Soviet Union, of course, is still a process that's going on, really. So you had these countries sort of shattering in violence in the cases of Yugoslavia and the USSR. You also had, with the end of the Iron Curtain, there were some sort of really benevolent things as well, that this frontier through Europe, this Iron Curtain, this barbed wire and minefields and watchtowers country, has now become a great big linear park. The nature was fairly undisturbed because obviously nobody was building on it. And so you have this ribbon of green territory going through Europe the way the old Iron Curtain did. And that's kind of a happy outcome, isn't it?
Yeah. So you've got sort of this green corridor sort of going. I hadn't thought of that before at all. I mean, there will be some who are saying, oh, but we need to put, you know, in the sort of the ways that the Knights of Malta or whatever put, you know, were saying, okay, we need to put something against the advancing Ottomans to keep them. I mean, there are those who will say, but we need to reinstate these borders because, hey, you know, the situation in you know, Syria and Afghanistan, and we need to reinforce our borders. But sort of borders have always been porous. I mean, there's never been a sort of a wall. I mean, Hadrian had a, you know, had a crack, but there was never sort of a great, Charlemagne never did a great central wall. You know, the Byzantines certainly never did a great central wall, and perhaps they had more, you know, the Eastern.
They should have done, yeah.
They should have done, exactly.
borders have always been porous. You always get kind of, you get one of two things happening at the border in the attitude of people. One of them is sort of becoming really nationalist because you've got something to prove. And I don't think it's an accident that sort of Hitler and Stalin both came from kind of peripheral territories to Germandom and Russiandom. And you get that reaction, but then you also get this sort of mixing and blurring of identity. Often people speak a dialect rather than or in addition to the mainstream language. So border people kind of on each side kind of have these ways of talking to each other, sometimes literally, in a way that the capitals don't understand. There is this kind of paradox about the Europe and of borders now, that we have incredibly soft borders between European countries, but there's quite a fierce external frontier. That in the Spanish enclaves, Melilla and Ceuta. There are fierce border walls around these places. It's really kind of draconian enforcement. And the Hungarian-Serbian border, There's a big fierce wall along there. And there's a bit of theatre by which the EU and Viktor Orban in Hungary sort of pretend to be on opposite sides for this. But actually, they're not. They really sort of, I think the European polity, the European people as a whole, do have this desire to kind of see the external frontiers quite harsh. Mm. But then there's a kind of paradox as well with this, that Europe still aspires to grow a bit. So that places like Serbia and Bosnia and Ukraine, the eventual idea is that they'll become under this umbrella of free movement. But in the meantime, there are these really hard borders between places.
I've crossed the border between Ceuta, which is Spain, into Ceuta, which is the Moroccan town on the other side of it, on foot, because normally people just sail in. To say that it's Monty Python-esque is quite something. I mean, I'm sure people were throwing excrement at each other. It really is. But that is the absolute, and we have to play a little bashkish and get through. And there are lots of wonderful uniforms everywhere. And there was an office to sign stuff in. And that's why when you go from Spain to Morocco on the ferry from Algeciras or whatever, you do the paperwork on the boat so that when you arrive, you sail through. When you do something like this, there are little historical gems. The notes here, and again, I've got this thing about the Reich because I like to see how people can get things so wrong. Something about a rock festival? Now put the tequila down, Lewis, and tell me about he's having a drink, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, but tell me about this rock festival. Presumably this is East Germany somewhere. What's going on?
That's right. This is this town, Ostritz. And it's sort of, again, it's this two-sided nature of border towns that sometimes you get incredibly nationalistic and sometimes it's kind of quite local and cosmopolitan at the same time. And in Ostritz, it's this little town right by the Polish border, so close to the border that the town station is actually in Poland and you walk back over the bridge. And there was a hotel there that was kind of accommodating to far-right stuff. So a group of far-right kind of people had a festival called Schild und Schwert, Shield and Sword, SS. And it started on 20th of April, Hitler's birthday.
Oh, so what could possibly go wrong? Yeah, go on.
You can't accuse these guys of subtlety, really.
Yes.
And so they had this festival. They had sort of rock art, Nazi rock and political activists and tattooists and so on. And also, weirdly, his position on the frontier was quite attractive to a demographic of Polish Nazi skinheads, which is a category you think sort of shouldn't exist, really, given the history of Nazism and Poland. And then the locals, and there's this institution kind of rent space from a convent called the International Meeting Center. And it's very German, very sort of earnest, upright, Christian kind of ethics. They organized protests against this festival. And the protests were basically successful. There were two lots of protests. There was one which was sort of all about peace and togetherness and so on. And there are a few anti-fa guys kind of there for a bit of fisticuffs as well. But most of the effort was sort of peaceful and wholesome. And then the next year, they hit upon this tactic of that we don't like drunk Nazis in our streets in this town. Even though people that vote for, quite a few people vote for the AFD, there is a line.
Yeah.
And they decided to buy all the beer from the supermarket so that the Nazis couldn't buy any beer and couldn't get tanked up. And so the Nazis had a thoroughly miserable time. This is 2019. And went home again feeling sort of deflated. And then COVID happened, so of course you don't have any of this stuff going on. And I don't think there's been a Nazi festival since.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you listen to any sort of skinhead music, you have to have a couple of beers to sort of get into it because it's so bleeding awful. And there are towns, because I think I've probably fallen through it myself, but there I was on the border with Belgium and Holland, I think, again, and you walk through these towns and then suddenly, apart from me driving to Rotterdam by mistake, literally the post office is here, you walk across and suddenly the cycle lanes appear and you think, aha, I'm in Holland.
Mm.
Or the Netherlands, sorry, the Netherlands, not Holland.
Yeah. Netherlands, yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. It's these little changes at borders that you kind of notice. Like on the Irish-UK border, you've noticed the street signs, the road signs kind of change to being in kilometres rather than miles and back and forward on some roads. There's a town in Belgium and the Netherlands called Bala, which is fragmented into 30 different pieces of little squares of Belgium and the Netherlands, kind of cheek by jowl with each other. And some houses, even the national border runs through the middle of their house. And there's one guy whose house is sort of straddles the border slightly. So his toilet's in Belgium and the rest of the house is in the Netherlands. So it's an international journey to go to the toilet.
Imagine you had to stamp your passport every time, you know? You'd be flinging things out the windows rather than using the gentleman's closet.
Yeah, no, it's an international journey. There's a shop which one ends in Belgium and the other's in the Netherlands. There's a pub garden because the licensing laws are different. And closing time is an hour earlier, I think, in the Netherlands than it is in Belgium. And there was a pub where people would have to move to that end of the beer garden to keep drinking.
Well, that's the sort of like quirk we like, though, isn't it, when you get stuff like that?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, no, it's this is why I like Borderlands, these sort of quirky stories, and it's how people adapt to these kind of funny rules and the lines being in absurd places, and people just sort of get on with life, and it's quite inspiring, really.
Yeah, and the other thing, the other thing is the fact that, you know, we talk about history in great sweeps, and this is, you know, it's going to be the 80th anniversary of the end of the war, and people go, oh, which was, you know, was appalling, but people who live on the border and have seen troops and whatever and political ideologies roll in and roll out, and these are the people who just go, okay, fine, but you know, the crop's still got to be coming in. We can still get a beer in the garden. And that perhaps is also an underlying message that, you know, we can all beat our drum about migration and whatever else is coming at us. But you know, at the end of the day, people without quoting Depeche Mode, people are people, and they get on no matter what side of a border you are from.
Definitely. And border life is kind of like that. I mean, people do cross over back and forward. I mean, you see the sort of sense of identity come through, for instance, when there's the World Cup in football, for instance. I mean, you get people kind of have their nationality and so on, obviously. But part of it is also this thing that I called provincial cosmopolitanism, that take the career of somebody like Robert Schuman, one of the founders of the EU. I mean, his dad was a German citizen, but had been born French. His mum was a Luxembourger. He ended up being a French citizen, but thought of himself as a European before all. What really interested me about border areas is this sort of juxtaposition of the local and the international. And you see that all over. And the borders that are saddest are the ones where the people have been ethnically cleansed from one side or both, like the border between Germany and Poland or the border between Poland and Ukraine. There's the people who have been moved away. I mean, 80 years now, as you say, since most of the Germans were expelled from what's now Western Poland.
Yeah, the Danzig and, corridor and all that sort of.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah. And you can still see the traces of the previous German life. There are little wayside shrines, and the language of those is German. You see some churchyards. They smashed up a lot of the German graveyards in the 40s, but some of them have been restored. And you see on buildings, you can sometimes, if the plaster work sort of starts to peel a bit, you see this German lettering below it,
yeah,
even though it's not Poland.
And you've got all those sort of Königsberg and all the Teutonic Knights stuff, which you could say, had it been in Western Germany or anywhere else, it might have been smashed up, you know, beyond repair. But there are still, like you said, there are still hints, there are still echoes, if not foundations of things from not only just 80 years ago, but sort of 400, 500 years ago.
Mm. And sometimes a regime will try and destroy them and get rid of them. Like the Russians tried to get rid of a lot of the German residue in Königsberg, now Kaliningrad. And these legacies have a way of creeping up on you. Like the Soviets built this massive, ugly tower block on top of the site of Königsberg Castle, the Teutonic Knights' capital. And the tower block ended up sort of sinking and subsiding because of all these German cellars below it. And you get people rediscovering old stuff, like the Russian people in Kaliningrad eat sort of some fairly traditional German-type food. It's really funny how the spirit of the place.
Yeah, politicians can come and go, but the food will keep going. I mean, I'm speaking to you, obviously, from what used to be Al-Andalus for 700 years.
Right.
And, you know, so, and that's what makes it quite funny when people say, oh, well, we're voting for Vox against immigrants. And it's like, well, you look a bit dark yourself, nothing to do with you. But you will, again, you will see Cordoba, Sevilla, Granada, Malaga have still got the house names and the place names, and we're still finding bits and pieces down here. What are you hoping? Because I've only got, I could talk to you about this until 5 o'clock, because we can tell, but the listeners will be throwing things. We've got a minute and 40, Lewis. What are you hoping that people are going to take and learn from the book?
I think, well, the big thing is borders are quirky and funny. That's why you should read the book. The other reason is that there's no opposition really between being sort of multinational and cosmopolitan and really valuing what your locality is. Because quite often that locality is built from diversity of one sort or another. Europe has been a mixed, interesting, fascinating place where different people come together for centuries. We tried dividing it up into hard lines, and that was a disaster. And it's imperfect. There will always be problems. But sort of living together and around the borders is something that really, really works. And it's really the way people like being.
The book is called Borderlines, A History of Europe in 29 Borders. It's by Lewis Baston. Lewis, if people want to find you online, where's the best place to track you down in the nicest possible way?
You can see me ranting on Blue Sky. I'm just Lewis Baston on that. I'm not very active on Twitter anymore. And my publishers are Hachette. You can go and find me there or on any good online retailer.
You can order the book via our own virtual bookstore as well.
Yes,
of course you can.
That's the way you should do it.
That's the way you should do it. Well done, Lewis. You've primed you properly. Go and get the book. It's absolutely brilliant. Lewis, thank you so much for your time today.
Real pleasure, Giles. Thank you very much.